G'day, this is Tom Uren of Seriously Risky Business, and I'm here today with the Gruck.
Hey, yeah, how you doing?
I'd like to thank the Cyber Initiative at the Hewlett Foundation and also founding corporate sponsors Proofpoint for their support of this series. And today we're going to talk about how cyberspace is different from other domains, and big industry players in particular have a huge role to play. And we're going to talk about what that means for how states operate in cyberspace, and not just military action, but all sorts of ways that they interact. So one of the things I said to you some time ago, Gruck, is that I feel like industry players, and the sort of industry players we're talking about are the big ones like Facebook, Google, but also Tencent and Yandex, internet giants, I guess, I really like the terrain and that they have a lot of autonomy to shape what governments can and can't do.
Yeah, so I think if we start with that, it's terrain with agency, right? So that they're not just a passive environment where things happen. They have their own agenda, I guess, you know, like they have their own goals, and it's always going to be a competition about who has more power and can make the other one do what they want. There's so much interesting stuff because we tend to just think of, you know, Google or Facebook or Microsoft, you know, like basically the Western internet giants.
And Amazon.
Right. And yeah, like they're based in the US. So when push comes to shove, they're going to do what the US wants them to do. Right. Like if the FBI shows up at Amazon and tries really hard, then ultimately Amazon's probably going to buckle.
Well, I think what I would say there is that there's a system of laws where up to a point, Amazon or Microsoft or whoever, they can take it to court, and there's a transparent, I don't know, a way for resolving those conflicts, right, that's based on something. Whereas I would argue that for states like China, the way of resolving those conflicts is ultimately you do what the Communist Party wants.
Right.
But I think broadly I agree with what you were saying.
Yeah. I'm going to temper what I was saying and say I agree with your framing of it. That's better. What I'm getting at is that sort of like in the West, they're going to sort of pursue Western values, we hope, yes, generally speaking.
Well, I think the Ukraine war is a great example of where that's a really extreme example where values are on the line. And all those companies, I would say, express the same values, right?
They didn't take the objective, neutral, libertarian stance of let the market decide or anything. They went with aggression and violation of international laws is wrong. We support the people who've been invaded.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I think there's an interesting dynamic there where those companies often portray themselves as citizens of the world. When they're trying to sell to everyone, we're global citizens. When it comes to an extreme example like Ukraine, they're forced to lay down their cards.
Yeah. So I think that one of the issues there is that there was also massive consumer sentiment.
Right.
That went on the side of Ukraine. So it would have been economically disadvantageous.
Ah, right. That's interesting.
To do hands-off things. So like if you looked at, I think, McDonald's or something like that, where they were looking at is losing 10% of our global revenue by exiting Russia going to be more expensive than whatever the backlash will be by staying in Russia? And I don't know what the numbers were, but clearly they thought that it was, you know, something it could afford.
So you're saying that it's a happy circumstance that both the values and the economics align in that case.
Right. You know, like, would it have gone the
other
way?
You've out-cynicked me.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So, between two cynics. I didn't want to appear too cynical, was my thing. Okay. But, you know, I think that's actually a really interesting example. I know I brought this up before, but basically the entire Ukraine government has moved onto Azure in data centers in Europe, right? And that is very much the terrain. But it's, again, another thing of agency, because by moving everything that the government was doing is now being managed, actively managed by Microsoft. Right. We know that earlier in the war, when everything was running in Ukraine, Microsoft was basically pretty much single-stepping every instruction on every computer in Ukraine to make sure that it never returned into the heap allocation or something, right? Like, they were really, really closely monitoring what was going on, while at the same time turning off updates and stuff, or turning off support and whatever to Russia. Now they've gone from that sort of monitoring in situ to moving it into their own environment and monitoring it there. And I think that's really interesting, because it also, in terms of agency, you know, what does Ukraine do if Microsoft suddenly goes, okay, here's the bill, you have 30 days or we turn off the computers?
Right, that's, I guess, the Starlink example, perhaps, where Starlink's become indispensable in the war in Ukraine, and now Starlink's asking the Pentagon for hundreds of millions of dollars.
That is another perfect example, actually, of industry and what it means for the state.
Yeah, so those scenarios, the government actually becomes beholden to those companies to some degree.
Right, and I think if we take the perspective of anyone who's not America, right? So we tend to do a lot of, or I tend to do at least a lot, you know, like if Australia does this, or if the FBI wants that, or, you know, yep, if the UK wants, let's take, you know, France, or Israel, South Africa, India, Singapore, these countries who are not, like, they're aligned, but they're not necessarily closely aligned, particularly for India.
Yes.
You know, so when Singapore has their opinions on things, they don't get catered to in the same way, and they don't have comparable resources to Google, right? If Google tells them to go pound sand, like, that's it, you know?
They just don't have the same leverage, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So I think it's worth thinking about literally anyone who isn't in Five Eyes for a second.
I think even from an Australian perspective, there's aspects that are difficult for us. So getting data out of Facebook, for example. It's been a very long process to get data out of Facebook, even when the police have warrants. And so that has taken many years, I think, to resolve. So I think the Cloud Act is going to resolve that. So even in the Five Eyes, it's not a lay down mazare. Right.
Like, some eyes are more equal than others, I think.
Well, I think there's one eye that's more.
It's the 1+4 eyes, I guess.
So this is, I guess we were talking about how this contrasts with other domains, right? So that's one example.
Right. So I was just going to say, like, that's pretty much exactly what was going on with Sri Lanka, for example, where they were complaining huge amounts to Facebook and stuff, like, these are huge problems, this disinformation is going on. And they went for months unable to get any sort of action at all until it was basically too late. Similarly, in Burma, there were activists who were complaining to Facebook, and Facebook didn't want to hear it, right? They want the revenue of expanding into a new place, but they don't want to deal with the costs of expanding into a new place. Right. So they don't want to hire, you know, they didn't want all these Burmese speakers and all these, you know, niche languages and stuff to figure out what's going on. And all they could see was there's this really high engagement group, and they don't know what they're on about, but they're getting lots of traction and a lot of people are signing up. And it turns out, oh yeah, like, it's because they're promoting genocide. You know, like, that was the big engagement thing.
Yeah. So I think so far we've talked about some of the big players, and we've talked, like you said, mostly from a US perspective, but I think what we've said is true for all those big players. So the Chinese players are tied to the Chinese state's interests, big Russian companies also to Russian interests. And I think to some degree that gives all those countries advantages, especially in their domestic cyberspace. So you look at the Chinese domestic internet and, you know, it's controlled and highly censored, and those companies have to be complicit. They must be complicit. There's no choice. Probably to a lesser degree, the Russian internet, lesser, but maybe increasing, increasing. So that's one aspect, is that those big companies are tied to the state or aligned to some degree, but they still have agency and can do their own thing, right?
So it's sort of I think they are related issues in a way. the difficulty of getting a foreign giant to do what you wanted to do is alleviated by having a local giant that you can actually tell what to do. And I think China was deliberate in how they pursued that, that they looked at the internet and said, this is dangerous. If we leave it to foreigners, we're going to have only foreign control over our information space. We do not want that. We're going to make sure that we have our own control of our information space. And I think, I suspect Russia did as well, though maybe not as deliberately. Like they were more, I don't know, Yandex, VK, Telegram was, you know, it still is in a way Russian. You know, they did create, I'm going to say it, they created their own internet, you know, like their own search, their own social, their own messenger, you know, like these sort of the basic functions that we think of when we think about the internet.
Yeah, my impression of the Chinese, the way the Chinese internet grew up is that they just excluded the Western players. And that just left space. And, you know, once you know that search is a thing, I don't think Baidu is as good as Google, but, you know, you can still create a search engine. And similarly, YouTube, perhaps the Western companies are more efficient or more effective. But those other companies exist because there was a vacuum.
Yeah, and I think actually Europe is probably really, really, like they missed the boat. Right. Like they, if they were smart and protectionist, you know, in the 90s and early 2000s, they should have been doing what China did. And then there would be European internet giants. As it is, you know, like there isn't even an email service from Europe that you, right? Like something we haven't talked about, which is the local law compliance. So, for example, things that are banned here in Thailand would be things that do, you know, lèse-majesté, where like you make fun of the king or the royal family or whatever. So when the West found out about this, they went nuts making all the sort of stuff that made fun of the king. And in Thailand, you know, it was all of the stuff got uploaded to YouTube. So the Thai government, being the genius group that it was, they blocked YouTube.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like, so what happened was, like, all of these people started uploading stuff to YouTube, and this was just after a coup, and there'd been, there was new censorship that had been installed, and so the government was like, okay, well, we've got this capability, we'll just block YouTube. And there'd been, like, no protests or anything but before the coup, but then the YouTube thing happened, and, like, the community here went nuts. People were really outraged. And so all of the internet cafes, which is where people were getting internet at the time, started installing VPNs so that people could access YouTube. And the government realized that it was actually worse to teach people how to bypass the censorship than to just allow it.
Yeah.
Right? And then they spoke to, like, Google stepped in, and somehow they can ban specific videos. Right.
Yeah. But geo-block specific videos.
Right.
Is that the, yeah.
Yeah. And so that's sort of what has happened.
I remember there used to be a time where the internet companies would say, oh, this kind of by local jurisdiction blocking is impossible. But I guess it really just comes down to a couple of if statements and a database lookup.
Right. There's things that are impossible
until you need to do them.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we've talked about, you know, these companies as terrain, how there's these different blocks, they're aligned, but they're not quite totally aligned. What else is there?
So I think there's an espionage angle, which plays on all of the things we've talked about already. So I think it came up in the Snowden leaks. It was the CIA, or must have been NSA, had access to Gmail accounts. Like, not direct access, but they were able to do, like, a sort of secret subpoena thing to get access to an account that no one knew about. And obviously, you need secrecy for espionage. Like, that's kind of that's kind of the thing. That's sort of its deal, you know? Like, that's the vibe. But you do need that because if people are using Gmail as their, like, COVCOM for spying, and you can monitor it by secretly subpoenaing and having access to those Gmail accounts, that is very, very valuable for counterintelligence. But if you're, say, Singapore, right, and you want to go and monitor that, you don't have that same secret subpoena backroom handshake capability. This is actually a thing that comes up directly in that a lot of the low-level agents that operate and work for China use WeChat.
Yeah, WeChat's like a very all-encompassing app, which has a whole lot of different functionality inside it. And one of the interesting things is the whole point of WeChat, at least in China, is to enable domestic surveillance. So it's kind of ironic that you would use it outside of China as a way for agents to talk. I believe that the foreign and domestic apps are different. So the overseas app just has the chat functionality, whereas the domestic app, I think, has, like, you can order rideshare, you can pay for stuff, kind of does everything.
Yeah. And that's a defensive aspect that we haven't talked about yet, which is that just like you can gain the ability to observe what's happening from your own giants, you can use your own local giants to prevent anyone else from gaining that visibility, right? Or you can at least monitor when they request it. So if in the US you suspect someone of being a Chinese agent and you see that they're using WeChat, you can't go and subpoena their data to look at it. Like, you could, but you would reveal that you are interested in that person and that they've been burned.
Yeah, so you could do it for a law enforcement purpose where you don't care giving it up, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Not for an espionage or intelligence purpose.
Yeah. And I think that's an angle of espionage that maybe hasn't been discussed enough. Like, it's one thing to look at it and be like, Google is in bed with NSA, you know, which they're not. But to look at it like our giants are complicit in spying on us, and to sort of remember that actually there's other giants out there who are working to thwart the intelligence agencies.
I always find it funny when there's a kind of outrage about something like that. So, for example, a lot of people use Proton Mail because they have this impression that it's less susceptible to interference by the state. But there was actually an example, I think,
recently
I wrote about maybe 5 or 6 months ago where Proton Mail assisted, it must have been Switzerland law enforcement.
Where they are based. I was wrong in saying that Europe doesn't even have an email giant. They do. They've got Proton.
Yeah. Right?
Proton is the closest thing they have to an email giant. And what do you find out? That the giant has to comply with the state where it lives.
Yeah. And if the state wants to do something bad enough, then they'll change laws and then there's no legal impediment and off you go. And I think in this case, it was Proton Mail didn't collect that data, but they cooperated with the state who got in front of Proton Mail to get the IP address or something like that.
Yeah. It was, I don't remember the details, but it freaked people out, and Proton was, they tried to thread the needle, I think, on there. Our privacy thing is still true. Just, you know, like, we never said we wouldn't give out that specific information if you took it before it was physically in our hand. Like, they.
That's right. Yeah, we didn't do it. It was just the people who collaborated with us did it.
Yeah, like.
And my response was, well, what do you expect? Mm-hmm. You know, you do bad enough stuff and you're on Proton Mail, they'll figure out a way.
Right. This is actually, that's one of the rules of OPSEC that I had all those years ago, which is no one is going to go to jail for you. So if you're relying on a company to take the legal brunt of whatever it is that you're doing so that you don't have to, you know, face those legal repercussions, that's not going to work, right? Like, the company at some point is going to go like, like we said, we're a logless VPN, but none of us is actually going to go and, like, protect your identity for the $5 a month that we get.
There's an irony there, isn't there, in that you, to appear to be trustworthy, you need to operate in a state that appears to be trustworthy.
Yeah.
But if you're operating in a state that appears to be trustworthy, you inherently can't totally be trusted because there's laws and stuff that actually get upheld.
And so I think The thing is, if you're in a state where the laws do not get upheld, then it's at the whim of whoever happens to be in charge at that point in time. So it's worse. So I know we're making fun of, you know, like the law could be changed and all that stuff, but we're full on in support of like the rule of law.
Yes. You know, yeah. You know, yeah, and what I'm getting at there is that sometimes problems arise that require a change in laws. Mm-hmm. In a well-functioning democracy, those problems are serious problems that you need to tackle. And laws change all the time. People are always writing new laws because the world is changing.
Yeah, so I think one of the things that we haven't touched on since we're speaking about espionage is states have recognized the power that these industry players have. And the particularly for, you know, espionage and, you know, surveillance and so on. So they have put their own assets in place. If you can't get the giant to do what you want it to do, maybe you can get someone hired at the giant, and then that person can do it for you on the sly after 5 o'clock or something. So, you know, the obvious examples that come up would be the Saudi guy that was working at Twitter that got arrested and done. There's the Indian agent that they mentioned. There are countless examples of people getting arrested for spying for China who had gotten jobs or consulting gigs or various other things. So I think it would be fair to say that if you are a state and you do not have assets working at Google, you are failing in your responsibilities as a state.
So Google actually released just 2 weeks ago, I think, a web series called Hacking Google, which actually started off with the Aurora hacks of Google by the Chinese state. And it turns out at the time they were after human rights activists. I guess the Chinese state thinks that they're a problem. Surprise, surprise. That was, I think, 2009. And so nowadays it seems like that's just the normal thing, right? So that's not a surprise. In fact, you're surprised if they're not doing it.
Right. You know you've arrived when you get state-level attention.
Right.
Right. You know, if you were an internet startup and the Chinese weren't trying to hack you, you're still small potatoes. You got to keep going.
Was that a surprise to you at the time?
No, it was not. I was aware that there were state hackers hacking everything. But it was very sort of vague in the, like, well, of course they're doing it. We didn't know any details or anything. So
you didn't know things like why or...
Exactly.
Like
we didn't know that these people are stealing IP because it's going to help their economy.
So the reason I ask, is that it seems like, I'll use air quotes, traditional espionage was very much state on state. And so it seemed like that kind of incident where it's state on company could be, you know, probably was a surprise to many people.
Yeah, well, part of why it wasn't so much to me was that, you know, if you've done your looking into the Cold War, you'll know about that the KGB Line T, which did industrial espionage.
Right.
And That was definitely still state focused. They were trying to steal defense technologies for their defense industry, or high end consumer technologies to improve their thing. So, like, they wanted to steal how to make computers, because computers were necessary for the state, and they didn't have their own industry. So you'd go out and you'd steal that. Like, it was a thing that existed, and it's not novel. It's sort of novel in terms of scope, I think. So, like, having a couple of KGB guys trying to get into IBM in the 70s is very different from the world that we have today.
Yeah, right. So I think what's interesting about that is it reveals what China's priorities are, in that human rights activists are a priority.
So this was actually a thing I wanted to discuss, I think, because this is where another area gets interesting, which is the thing that we have touched on, which is the, you know, local laws. But what happens when you sort of disagree with the local laws, as in this case, where the Chinese consider Falun Gong or Uyghurs as problems that need to be addressed, or people who...
Yeah. So I've written about this in the past, and the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, has five poisons. The Uyghur independence movement, the Tibetan independence movement, pro-democracy activists, Hong Kong freedom activists, and the Falun Gong.
You know, I think this is a thing, right? Where, for example, when Zoom in 2021 or 2020, it was the Tiananmen Square anniversary, and there were these pro-democracy Chinese calls that got shut down by Zoom. And Zoom was complying with Chinese law and doing what the Chinese managers were saying they had to do. But clearly, the U.S. was not super happy about, you can't do that.
Yeah. That's I think it's a difficult situation for companies sometimes. Like, you can't do both things at once, obviously.
Right. And so, as I mentioned with the laissez-majeure, it's one thing where it's like, ha, 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 that small quirky nation has their like little weird ideas of what's illegal. But it's quite another thing when a large, powerful nation who has their own giants has their ideas about what's legal and what isn't, and who has their own ideas of what is right and wrong, and they want to enforce that globally. And that's probably one of the big debates of our time, but it has industry right in the middle. And I forget if it was Facebook or Google, but Russia was trying to force them to comply with new data laws of some sort. And they literally threatened to come and arrest the executives at the office in Moscow if they didn't comply.
Yeah, I think that was Google. Yeah.
Right. We can talk a lot about how much power Google has, and it's truly massive. But when Russia says, we're going to arrest you, like you personally.
Yeah. I read a while ago that there's laws described as hostage-taking laws. And I think the example was India and Twitter, and they required a local office. And the theory or the argument was that they require the local office in order to have people that they could have leverage over for exactly that purpose, to arrest. So it seems like we started off with this discussion of these internet giants are hugely important. They kind of form the terrain, but they also are in a way the football that's kicked around on that terrain. So thanks a lot, Grant.
Hey, always a pleasure.